Yeah, you got to have wrong turns, exactly. December 3rd, 2008. Taking evolution seriously. Back in 1904, sociologist Max Weber proposed that the modern period was witnessing, quote, the disenchantment of the world, unquote, a process which traditional mythic ideas that wove meaning into human experience were being replaced by the alienating and dehumanizing worldview of materialist science. There's some truth to Weber's thesis, but I'm not sure he anticipated the inevitable backlash, the Procrustean stretching and lopping of scientific ideas in the popular imagination that has turned many of them into substitute myths. One example has been much on my mind of late, is the way that the theory of evolution has been manhandled into a surrogate mythology. The reason it's been on my mind is simple enough. Whenever I discuss peak oil at a lecture, book signing, or some other public setting, it's a safe bet that someone will raise a hand and ask what I think about the possibility that the approaching crisis is part of our transition to a new evolutionary level. I am always left wondering what to say in response, because this sort of question is almost always rooted in the notion that evolution is a linear movement that leads onward and upward through a series of distinct stages or levels, and this notion is a fair misstatement of the way evolution takes place in nature. Few things in the history of ideas are quite so interesting as the way that new discoveries get harnessed into the service of old obsessions. When X-rays were first detected in 1895, for example, one of the first results was panic over the possibility that the new rays might make it possible to see through clothing. The New Jersey State Legislature actually debated a bill to ban the use of X-rays in opera glasses. Widely inaccurate as it was, this notion was rooted in profound fears about sexuality, and so it took many decades to dispel. When I was a child, ads in comic books still claimed to sell X-ray glasses that would let you see people naked. Something not that different happened to the theory of evolution. And thus, nearly all of today's popular notions about evolution are shrapnel from the head-on collision between Darwin's theory and the obsessions of an era in which that theory emerged. Social class, rather than sex, was the driving force here. As religious justifications for the English caste system faltered, the manufacture of scientific justification for social hierarchy became a growth industry. And by the time the ink was dry on the first copies of The Origin of Species, evolution was already being drafted into service in this dubious cause. The resulting belief system was very nearly a parody of George Orwell's Animal Farm in advance. All living things evolve, but some are more evolved than others. Now, of course, this is nonsense. A human being, a gecko, a dandelion, and a single-celled blue-green alga are all equally evolved. That is, they have all been shaped to the same degree by the pressures of their environment, and their ancestors have all undergone an equal amount of natural selection. We think of humans as more evolved, quote-unquote, than blue-green alga because Victorian social Darwinists such as Herbert Spencer engaged a conceptual sleight of hand, transforming the amorphous outward surge of life available life toward available niches into a ladder of social status, with English gentlemen on the top level and everybody else and everything else slotted in place further down. The concept of evolutionary stages or levels was essential to this conjurer's act, since it allowed social barriers between classes to be mapped onto the biological world. In nature, though, evolution has no levels. It just has adaptations. There's no straight line of progress along which living things can be ranked. Instead, evolutionary lineages splay outward like the branches of an unruly shrub. Sometimes those branches take unexpected turns, but these evolutionary breakthroughs can no more be ranked in an ascending hierarchy than organisms can. They move outward into new niches rather than upward to some imagined goal. There are any number of examples from nature. The one I want to choose here is the evolution of bats. The ancestor of the first bats were shrew-like, insect-eating nocturnal mammals related to early primates who scampered through the forest canopies of the Eocene around 60 million years ago. For animals that lived in trees, the risk of falling is a constant source of evolutionary pressure, and adaptations that will help manage the danger will likely spread through a population. That's how sloths got their claws. New World monkeys got their prehensile tails, and many animals of past and present got extra skin that function as a parachute. If the extra skin bridges the gap between forelegs and hind legs, the most common adaptation, you get the ability to glide, like flying squirrels, colugas, and the like. You've got a viable adaptation, and there you stop. If the extra skin is mostly on or around the forelimbs, though, you've just jumped through the door to a new world, because you can control your glide much more precisely, and you can put muscle into the movements. In other words, you can begin to fly. Once you can do better than a controlled fall, furthermore, the trillions of nasty insects flitting through the forest air are on your menu, and the better you can fly, the more you can catch. The result is ferocious evolutionary pressure toward improved flight skills, and in a few hundred thousand generations, you've got agile flyers. That's what happened to bats, as it happened to some 200 million years earlier to the ancestors of the pterodactyls. By 55 million years ago, bats almost identical to today's insect-eating bats were darting through the Eocene skies. Sonar seems to have taken a while to evolve, and some offshoots of the family, the big fruit bats and flying foxes, for example, took even longer. But the basic adaptations were set, and to the discomfiture of countless generations of mosquitoes and moths have remained ever since. As evolutionary breakthroughs go, the leap into flight was a massive success. Bats are the second most numerous of mammal orders, exceeded only by the rodents, but it's impossible to fit the breakthrough that carried them into any linear scheme. Applying an ecological concept to human social systems always takes tinkering, but there are good reasons to accept the idea that societies are capable of evolution. Like populations of other living things, human communities face pressures from their environments and adapt or perish in response. Here again, though, the evolutionary process moves outward in all directions rather than ascending an imaginary hierarchy of levels. Hunter-gatherer systems seem to have been the original form of human society, but other forms branched off as adaptations opened doors to possibilities that were likely as appealing at the time as the bug-filled night sky must have been to the first clumsily flapping protobats. Where large herbivores could be tamed, therefore, nomadic herding societies came into being. Where many food plants could be raised in intensive gardens, tribal horticultural societies were born. Where extensive fields of seed-bearing grasses offered the best option for survival, agrarian societies took shape. As it turned out, grains could be bred to yield large surpluses that could be transported and stored. So the agrarian system opened the door to large-scale divisions of labor and the rise of cities. These, in turn, made complex material culture possible and ultimately drove the creation of the machines that broke into Earth's stockpile of carbon, fossil carbon, and gave the modern world its three centuries of exuberance. Thus, industrial society is not more evolved than other societies, for that matter, or for that matter, less evolved. It was simply the most successful adaptation to the evolutionary pressures that opened up once fossil fuel energy had been tapped. And it outcompeted other systems in something in the same way that an intensive exotic outcompetes less robust native organisms. As fossil fuels deplete and climate change unfolds, the balance of evolutionary pressures is shifting. And as the new reality of limits takes hold, selection will favor those systems that are better adapted to the new ecological constraints of global climate instability, energy scarcity, and resource shortage. The fact that those new systems are better adapted to new realities, however, does not free them from the human condition. This is where the rubber meets the road, because the people who ask me about the prospects of a new evolutionary level are rarely asking whether the societies of the future will be better adapted to an environment of resource scarcity. They are generally asking whether societies on the other side of an imagined evolutionary leap will be free from problems such as poverty, war, and environmental destruction. The best way to assess this, it seems to me, is to consider what happened the last time human social evolution yielded a breakthrough to a new way of living in the world. That is, the rise of industrial societies beginning around 1750. Agrarian societies suffered from poverty, war, and environmental destruction, and so did all other evolutionary levels, quote-unquote, or rather adaptations, right back to the hunter-gatherers. Many hunter-gatherers among the First Nations in North America, for example, had sharp social inequalities, a busy slave trade, and a long history of fierce tribal wars. Their ecological relationships were less problematic, since those native societies that failed to find a balance with nature, such as the mound builders and the people of the Chaco Canyon, collapsed long before 1492. Just as bats face the same experiences of hunger, social squabbles, and the unfriendly attentions of predators as their ancestors, the societies that took up industrialism experienced poverty, war, and environmental destruction just like earlier societies. And it's hard to think of a good reason why the new societies that emerge in response to the evolutionary pressures of a deindustrial age should be exempt from the same troubles. Evolutionary adaptations can make things easier for living things. Plenty of predators in the Eocene must have been discomforted when bats evolved the ability to flutter away to safety. But no living thing is exempt from the balances of the natural world. It's a mistake, in other words, to see evolution as a movement toward utopia. Mm-hmm. When I've tried to explain any of the above in public, though, someone, and it's not always the same someone who asked the original question, usually insists that this may be how biological evolution works, but spiritual evolution is different. Some of my readers just now may have come up with the same objection. All I can say in response is I know of none of the world's great spiritual traditions that would approve the claim that people living in extravagant lifestyles of wealth and privilege, that is, after all, a fair description of life in modern industrial societies from the standpoint of the rest of human experience, can expect a sudden leap to an even more comfortable and convenient life, just because they happen to want it, and would find it a useful way to avoid dealing with the consequences of their own short-sighted choices. This may seem unduly harsh. Still, the notion that an evolutionary leap will extract us from the mess we've made for ourselves is as much a distortion of the realities of the evolutionary process as any social Darwinist screed. If people want to believe that a miracle will rescue them from the predicament of industrial society, they have every right to their faith. But it would confuse communication a little less to call it a miracle instead of trying to wrap it in the borrowed prestige of Darwin's theory. Perhaps it's the bias instilled by my own Druid faith, furthermore, but it seems to me that if we're going to use evolution as a metaphor, we need to start by taking evolution seriously, rather than imposing our own fantasies on the very different stories that nature is telling us.
Wow. That's our Archdruid.
Wednesday, December 24th, 2008. History's Arrow. One of the advantages of being a druid is that you get to open your holiday presents 4 days early. Last Sunday's winter solstice was pleasant, with a scattering of snow on the ground outside and candles burning indoors as we celebrated the rebirth of the sun. As one hinge of the year's cycle, the solstice is a good time to ponder the shape of time, on the small scale with hopes for the year to come and memories of the one now passing, the middle scale as I think back on past holidays and uncertain number that still lie ahead, and the large scale with which this blog is mostly concerned. In keeping with that seasonal theme, I want to talk a bit about history on the large scale and the ideas our culture uses to frame the idea of history. One of the things that has interested me most about the reactions to the ideas about the shape of the future I've presented here on the Archdruid Report is the extent to which so many of them presuppose one particular way of thinking about history, like the character in one of Molière's plays, who was astonished to find that he had been speaking prose all his life. A great many people these days have embraced a distinctive philosophy of history, but never quite seem to have noticed that fact. This is hardly a new thing. One of the ironies of the history of ideas is the way that so many cultural themes, surfacing first in avant-garde intellectual circles, are dismissed out of hand by the grandparents of those who will one day treat them as obvious facts. Modern nationalism, to cite one example out of many, began with the romantic visions
of a few European poets spilled out into the world largely through music and the arts and turned into massive political force that shredded the political maps of four continents. To some extent, this is the intellectual's revenge on an unreflective society. The men of affairs who treat the arts as amenities and dismiss philosophy as worthless abstractions spend their workadays unknowingly mouthing the words of dead philosophers and acting out the poems they never read on the stage of current events. The way of thinking about history I have in mind today has followed the same trajectory. Karl Popper, who has devoted much of his career to critiquing it, called it historicism. This is the belief that history as a whole moves inevitably in a single direction that can be known in advance by human beings. Exactly what that single direction is supposed to be varies from one historicist to another. Choose any point along the spectrum of cultural politics, and you can find a version of historicism that treats the popular ideals and moral concerns common to that viewpoint as the linchpin of the historical process. The details differ, the basic assumption remains the same. That same assumption has also spread to infect nearly every contemporary discussion of change over time. After my post, Taking Evolution Seriously, appeared a few weeks back, for example, one of my longtime readers forwarded me comments from a discussion on an email list, whose members took me to task in no uncertain terms for my discussion on the evolutionary process. What I said, that no organism is more evolved than any other, and that evolution has no particular direction or goal, they insisted I was simply wrong. Evolution progresses in the direction of increased complexity over time, one person claimed, and another suggested that I would simply be better informed if I read more of the writings of the late Stephen Jay Gould. Now, I have no objection to reading more of Gould's work, as I've already enjoyed many of his books. For that matter, I've read a fair amount of evolutionary theory, beginning with Darwin and continuing through some of the most recent theorists, and also took college courses in evolutionary ecology and several related branches of environmental science. One thing this taught me is that attempts are always being made to stuff evolution into a historicist jacket, straitjacket. Another thing I learned is that these attempts are rejected by the great majority of evolutionary biologists, simply because the evidence doesn't fit. Some evolutionary lineages have moved from simple to more complex forms over time, but others have gone in the other direction. And the vast majority of living things on Earth today belong to phyla that have not added any noticeable complexity since the Paleozoic. Nor has the Earth's biosphere as a whole become more complex. The entirety of the Cenozoic era, that 65 million years between the last dinosaurs and us, has been less biologically rich than the Mesozoic era that preceded it. And the global cooling of the last 15 million years or so has seen a decrease in the world's biological complexity as ecosystems have adapted to more rigorous conditions that have spread over much of the world. The facts on the ground, then, simply don't support any claim that evolution moves toward greater complexity. No other version of historicism fares any better when applied to evolution either. Yet 99 times out of 100, when you hear people outside of a university biology department talking about evolution, what they have in mind is a linear process leading in a particular direction. They are, in other words, talking about historicism. Trace these ideas back along their own evolutionary lineage, and a fascinating history emerges. The founder of the current of thought that gave rise to today's historicism was an Italian monk named Joachim of Flores, who lived from 1145 to 1202, and spent most of the latter half of his life writing obtuse books on theology. Most Christian theologians before his time accepted Augustine of Hippo's famous dictum between the city of God and the city of man, and assigned all secular history to the latter category, one more transitory irrelevance to be set aside by the soul in search of salvation. Joachim's invention was the claim that the plan of salvation works through secular history. He argued that all human history, secular as well as sacred, was divided into three ages: the age of law under the Old Testament, the age of love under the New, and the age of liberty that was about to begin. Some of his theories were formally condemned by church councils, but his core theory proved unstoppable. Every generation of church reformers from the 13th century to the 18th seized on his ideas and claimed that their own arrival marked the coming of the Age of Liberty. Every generation of church conservatives stood Joachim on his head, insisting that the three ages marked the progressive loss of divine guidance and portrayed the arrival of the latest crop of reformers as Satan's final offensive. Still awake?
Yep.
As secular thought elbowed theology aside, in turn, Joachim's notion of history as the working out of a divine plan got reworked into secular theories of humanity's grand destiny. Notable among these was the theory he argued by Marquis de Condorcet in Sketch for a Historical Picture of the Progress of the Human Spirit in 1794. A rich historical irony surrounds this work. Condorcet had been a strong supporter of the French Revolution and hoped that the end of the monarchy would usher in a republic of reason. Instead, he was condemned to death by the new government and wrote his sketch while he was on the run from the guillotine. He nonetheless described human history as an inevitable rise from barbarism to a future of reason and progress in which all of human life would undergo endless improvement. Condorcet's faith in perpetual progress found many listeners, but a more influential voice was already waiting in the wings. George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, who managed the rare feat of becoming both the most influential and the most unreadable philosopher of modern times. In his Philosophy of History, which was published shortly after his death in 1831, he argued that history was the process by which human freedom, for which for him was not quite the freedom of the individual, he idolized Napoleon and the government of Prussia, was maximized in time. In Hegel's mind, Joachim's threefold rhythm of history was reworked into the three phases of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, by which every opposition was resolved into a higher unity. Hegel's view of history became enormously influential, less through his own work. I challenge any of my readers to plow through the Philosophy of History and come out the other side with anything but a headache, than through the writings of those influenced by him. Political radicals at both ends of the spectrum jumped on Hegel's ideas. On the left, Karl Marx used Hegelian ideas as the foundation for his philosophy of class warfare and communist revolution. On the right, Giovanni Gentile, the pet philosopher of Mussolini's fascist regime, was a rigorous Hegelian. For that matter, Francis Fukuyama, who played a role much like Gentile's for the neoconservative movement, drew his theory of an end to history from Hegel. Still, the spread of Hegel's ideas isn't limited to the radical fringes or even those who know who Hegel was. I think most people who have been following the issue of peak oil for more than a few months have noticed, when the subject comes up for discussion in public, one of the most common responses: "Oh, they'll think of something." Ask the person who says this to explain, the odds are that you'll be told that every time the world runs out of some resources, they find something new, and the result is more progress. This is Hegel reframed in terms of economics. Shortage is the thesis, ingenuity the antithesis, and progress the synthesis. The insistence that the process is inevitable puts the icing on the Hegelian cake. More generally, the logic of historicism governs the entire narrative. History's arrow points in the direction of progress, and so whatever happens, the result will be more progress. Examples could be added by the page, but I hope the point has been made. Still, it's crucial to realize just how deeply historicism has become entrenched in all modern thinking. If, dear reader, you think yourself untouched by it, I encourage you to try a thought experiment. You awake?
Yep.
The average species, paleontologist tells us, lasts about 10 million years. Imagine that by some means, a visit from a time machine, say, that leaves you holding a history of humanity written by an intelligent species descended from chipmunks. You'll find out that this is how long we have. You won't achieve godhood. We won't achieve godhood or reach the stars or destroy the planet or enter utopia. Instead, the 9 million years we've got left will be like recorded history so far. Civilizations will rise and fall. Our species will create great art and literature, interpret the universe in various ways, explore many modes of living on the earth. Finally, millions of years from now, it will slowly lose the struggle for survival, dwindle to small populations in isolated areas, and go extinct. If that turns out to be humanity's future, would you be satisfied with it? Or would you feel that some goal has been missed, some destiny betrayed? If the latter, what makes you think that? Now, of course, it may be a waste of breath to contend with ideas as pervasive and deeply rooted as historicism. But the effort has to be made, if only because historicism has a dismally bad track record as a basis for prophecy. Name a historicist belief system that's been around for more than a few years, right back to Joachim of Flores himself, and you'll find a trail of failed predictions of the imminent arrival of the goal of history. Joachim himself apparently believed that the Age of Liberty would arrive in 1260. No such luck. If we are to have any useful sense of the future ahead of us, historicist belief systems are among the worst sources of guidance available to us. Fortunately, there are other choices. In next week's post, I plan on talking about some of those. In the meantime, best holiday wishes to all my readers, whatever holidays you celebrate at this time of year. The Archdruid Report, last day of 2008, Wednesday, December 31st, 2008. History, meaning, and choice. The end of one year and the beginning of another has been a time for celebration and reflection since around the time calendars were invented. And even though the date has been kicked around the yearly cycle pretty comprehensively by history's boot, it hasn't been that long, all things considered, since the civil year in the English-speaking world began in late April. There's a point to the custom. Our individual lives have their turning points, and so does the collective life of communities and cultures. The hinge of time when one year changes to another provides a useful reminder of such things. It's in this spirit that I want to wrap up one of the threads of discussion that's shaped my posts on the Archdruid Report for several weeks now. Several times now in these essays, I've brought up the names of some of the major theorists of cyclical history, Giambattista Vico, Oswald Spengler, Arnold Toynbee, and talked a little about how their ideas illuminate the current crisis of industrial civilization. For the last three centuries, the traditions these authors and their works embody has challenged the historicist faith discussed in last week's post, the belief that history has an arrow with the words "this way only" painted on it somewhere, that, in other words, it has a direction, a purpose, and a goal. If a meaningful sense of history is a tool worth having as we face the predicament of our time, and historicism does not provide such a sense, and to my mind at least, both these assertions are far more true than not, the vision of cyclic history is one place where something more useful might be found. Mind you, cyclic and historicist views of history are both out of fashion these days. There's no shortage of scholars who lump them together as meta-narratives and insist that they should be banned from serious history. The problem with this insistence is that human beings think in stories as inevitably as they walk with feet. Attempting to chase meta-narratives out of history simply results in assaults on those meta-narratives unpopular enough to be noticed, while those that are accepted unthinkingly slip past the centuries with ease.
Wow, that is so true.
The statement "history follows no pattern," after all, is itself a meta-narrative, a narrative about the historical narratives that embodies a particular approach to historical knowledge. Thus, attempts to talk about the shape of history should not be dismissed out of hand. The question that needs to be asked of them is simply whether they help to make sense of the course of historical events. Mm-hmm. Yet this question itself can be read in more than one way.
How much is today's events important to understand?
Historicist and cyclic theories of history both try to make sense of history, but they try to make sense of it, different kinds of sense. They get different answers because they ask fundamentally different questions. At the core of historicism is the intuition that history has a meaning, while at the core of the cyclic vision is the intuition that history has a pattern.
Wow.
And meaning and pattern are by no means interchangeable terms.
Right.
Most historicist theories, mind you, find pattern as well as meaning in history. Most cyclic theories, by contrast, leave questions of the meaning of history entirely open. And some, Oswald Spengler was particularly outspoken in this regard, reject the idea that history as a whole has any meaning or purpose with as much vehemence as a positivist. Spengler's reasons for this rejection are worth examining, because his rejection of historicism went deeper than just about any other thinker I can name. He argued that history can have no overall meaning because it's impossible to talk of meaning at all except within the worldview of a given culture. Each culture evolves its own distinct way of experiencing human life in the universe, and the only meaning humans can know is embodied in these distinctive worldviews. No culture's worldview is more or less true than any other, nor are the worldviews of cultures that arise later on in history an improvement in any sense on the ones that came before. Each culture defines reality uniquely through its own dialogue with the inscrutable patterns of nature and the human experience. Interestingly, Spengler applied this logic to his own work as well. He offered his theory not as an objective truth about historical cycles, but simply as the best account of historical cycles that could be given from within the perspective of modern Western, in his terms, Faustian, humanity. When it got past superficialities, much of the criticism that has been directed at Spengler's work over the last 9 decades took aim squarely at his insistence that every culture's worldview is equally valid and that humanity therefore does not progress. What makes his resolute rejection of our culture's superiority unacceptable to so many people, though, is precisely that it defends against the pervasive historicism of our age. Only the belief that history is headed somewhere in particular, with our civilization presumably in the lead, makes his thesis in any way problematic. For what it's worth, I think that Spengler was right in principle, but wrong on a minor but important detail. He was certainly right to point out that trying to rank worldviews of different cultures according to some scheme of progress or another yields self-serving nonsense. Ancient Egyptians understood the universe in one way, and modern Americans understand it in another, not because Americans are right and Egyptians were wrong, or vice versa, but because the two cultures were not talking about the same things, nor were they using the same symbolic language for the discussion. A worldview based on explorations of metaphysics of human life in the language of myth cannot meaningfully be judged by the standards of a worldview that takes analysis of the physical world in the language of mathematics as its starting point. To say that the industrial world's technological progress proves the superiority of its worldview merely begs the question, since the Egyptians did not value technological progress. They valued cultural stability, and they achieved it, maintaining cultural continuity for well over 3,000 years, a feat that our own civilization is not likely to equal. By their standards, for that matter, our society's ephemeral fashions, ceaseless cultural turmoil, and incoherent metaphysics would have branded it an abject failure at the most basic tasks of human social life. As I see it, though, Spengler undervalued the process by which certain kinds of technique invented by one culture can enrich later cultures. A very relevant example is classical logic. Among the supreme achievements of the Apollinarian culture, which was inherited in turn by the Indian, Syrian, Byzantine Arabic, in Spengler's language, Magian, and Faustian cultures. No two of these cultures did the same thing with that inheritance. A toolkit Greeks devised to pick apart spoken language was used in India to analyze the structure of consciousness, in the Levant to contemplate the glories of God, and in Europe with the European diaspora to unravel the mysteries of matter. Without Greek logic, though, some of the greatest creations of all three interior cultures, in inheritor cultures, the rich philosophical dimensions of Hinduism and Buddhism, the great theological syntheses of Islam and Christianity, or the fusion of logic with experience that gave rise to the modern scientific method, certainly could not have been done as easily, and quite possibly might not have happened at all. What this implies is that while history is not directional, it can be cumulative.
Wow, that's a huge distinction.
Nothing.
Greek logic.
Yep. What this implies is that while history is not directional, it can be cumulative. Nothing in the history of cultures older than Greece suggests that the emergence of logic was inevitable, just as nothing in the subsequent history of logic justifies the claim that logic is developing towards some goal or another. Still, the toolkit of logic, absent before the Greeks, enriched a series of cultures that flourished after them. There are countless examples, and they span the full range of human cultural creations. For a small but telling example, consider how the practice of counting prayers on a string of beads, which originated in India, has spread through most of the world's religions. For another, consider the way that 40 centuries of East Asian intensive agriculture inspired the emergence of organic growing methods that are probably our best bet for tomorrow's food supply. Every person who finds spiritual solace in prayer or meditation with a rosary, or is planning a backyard organic garden to help put food on the table next year, has good reasons to be grateful for the slow accumulation of technique over time. Thus, there's a fine irony in the insistence that so many people these days have that evolution will shortly relieve us of the necessity to deal with the consequences of our own mistakes and get history back on track to their imagined goal. They're right that the historical changes underway are now evolutionary in nature. Their mistake lies in thinking, to put the matters perhaps a bit too harshly, that evolution is some sort of cosmic tooth fairy who can be counted on to leave a shiny new future under the modern world's pillow to replace one rotted away by three centuries of extravagant living.
Oh my gosh.
Instead, the historical development of cultures parallels the way that evolution actually works in nature. Cultures, like species, tend to collect those adaptations that meet their needs and discard the ones that don't. Thus, those techniques that happen to meet the needs of more than one culture tend to survive more often than those that don't. Just as those cultures that are able to make use of a suitable range of inherited techniques are more likely to thrive than those that do not. I trust none of my readers are drowsy enough by this point to think that I am suggesting that the accumulation of useful techniques is the meaning, purpose, or goal of history. From my point of view, whatever that may be worth, meanings, purposes, and goals are not to be found in any objective sense in the brute facts of existence. They are always and only attributes created creatively to existence by conscious persons. And the emergence of meanings, purposes, and goals common to more than one person depends on the relation between the person proposing these things and those who choose to accept or reject them. Atheists may read this statement in one sense, and religious people in quite another. Interestingly enough, the logic works either way. Like biological evolution, though, the cultural evolution I am proposing here is in no way inevitable. The crises that surround the decline and fall of civilizations in particular very often become massive choke points at which many valuable things are lost. One reasoned response to the approach of such a choke point in our own time thus might well be a deliberate effort to help the legacy of the present reach the waiting hands of the future. The same logic that leads the ecologically literate to do what they can to keep threatened species alive through the twilight of the industrial age, so that biological evolution has a wide palette of raw materials as possible in the age that follows, applies just as well to cultural evolution. Thus, it may not be out of place to imagine a list of endangered knowledge to go along with today's list of endangered species, and to take broadly equivalent steps to preserve both. There are certainly other meanings, purposes, and goals that can be found in, or more precisely applied to, either the inkblot patterns of history as a whole, or the specific challenges we face right now, in the early stages of industrial civilization's decline and fall. We can decide as individuals whether to build on the heritage of our culture, to explore the legacies that have been handed down to us from other cultures, or to scrap the lot and try to break new ground, knowing all the while that other individuals will make their own choices and the relative success of the results, rather than any preference of ours, will determine which of them plays the largest role in shaping the future. My own choice centers on the preservation of those parts of the modern world's heritage that I find most valuable and most promising as tools for the futures that seem most likely to me. Again, he says, my own choice centers on the preservation of those parts of the modern world's heritage that I find most valuable and most promising as tools for the futures that seem most likely to me. If that way of putting things seems uncomfortably subjective, personal, and even arbitrary, dear reader, you're beginning to get the point of the last month or two of Archdruid report posts. Our own subjective, personal, and arbitrary perceptions are the only things we have to go on, and the results tend to be much less problematic when we accept this fact, rather than trying to cast the shadows of our desires onto history's arc and stare at them in the fond delusion that we're staring destiny in the face. One way or another, we all have choices to make as the new year dawns. Some of us will face the harsh decisions that come with unemployment, foreclosure, and bankruptcy. Others will encounter the moral challenges that face those who have wealth while others go hungry. Still others will have other choices. Not everyone will be at liberty to take the deindustrial future into account as they make their choices. But I hope some will do so. And whatever you choose in this regard, whether or not it corresponds to any of the things I've discussed here, it might be wise to take action on the basis of your decisions sooner rather than later. A year, after all, is not the only thing that's ending around us just now. Wednesday, September 12th, 2007. The innovation fallacy. Oh, I like that, the innovation fallacy.
Yeah.
The core concept that has to be grasped to make sense of the future looming up before us, it seems to me, is the concept of limits. Central to ecology, and indeed all the sciences, this concept has failed so far to find any wider place in the mindscape of industrial society. The recent real estate bubble is simply another example of our culture's cult of limitlessness at work. Cult of limitlessness at work. As real estate investors insist that housing prices were destined to keep on rising forever. Of course, those claims prove to be dead wrong, as they always are. But the fact that they keep on being made, it's only been a few years, after all, since the same rhetoric was disproven just as dramatically in the tech stock bubble of the late 1990s, showing just how allergic most people are to the idea that there's an upper limit to anything. It's this same sort of thinking that drives the common belief that limits on industrial society's access to energy can be overcome by technological innovations. This claim looks plausible at first glance, since the soaring curve of energy use that defines recent human history can be credited to technological innovations that allowed human societies to get at the huge reserves of fossil fuels stored inside the planet. The seemingly logical corollary is that we can just repeat the process, coming up with innovations that will give us ever-increasing supplies of energy forever. Most current notions about the future are based on some version of this belief. The problem, and it's not a small one, is that the belief itself is based on a logical fallacy. One way to see how this works, or more precisely, doesn't work, is to trace the same process in a setting less loaded with emotions and mythic narratives than the future of industrial society. Imagine for a moment, then, that we're discussing an experiment involving microbes in a petri dish. The culture medium in the dish contains 5% of a simple sugar that the microbes can eat, and 95% of a more complex sugar they don't have the right enzymes to metabolize. We put a drop of fluid containing microbes into the dish, close the lid, and watch. Over the next few days, a colony of microbes spreads through the culture medium, feeding on the simple sugar. Then a mutation happens, and one microbe starts producing an enzyme that lets it feed on the more abundant complex sugar. Drawing on this new food supplies, the mutant microbe and its progeny spread rapidly, outcompeting the original strain until finally the culture medium is full of mutant microbes. At this point, though, the growth of the microbes is within hailing distance of the limits of the supply of complex sugar. As we watch the microbes through our microscopes, we might begin to wonder whether they can produce a second mutation that will let them continue to thrive. Yet this obvious question misleads, because there's no third sugar in the culture medium for another mutation to exploit. The point that has to be grasped here is as crucial as it is easy to miss. The mutation that gave the microbes access to an existing supply of highly concentrated food, the mutation gave the microbes access to an existing supply of highly concentrated food. It didn't create the food out of thin air. If the complex sugar hadn't existed, the mutation would have yielded no benefit at all. As the complex sugar runs out, further mutations are possible. Some microbes might end up living on microbial waste products. Others might kill and eat other microbes. Still others might develop some form of photosynthesis and start creating sugars from sunlight. But all these possibilities draw on resources much less concentrated and abundant than the complex sugar that made the first mutation succeed so spectacularly.
Sugar. More sugar.
Nothing available to the microbes will allow them to continue to flourish as they did in the heyday of the first mutation. Does this same logic apply to human beings? A cogent example from 20th century history argues that it does. When the Second World War broke out in 1939, Germany arguably had the most innovative technology on the planet. All through the war, German technology stayed far ahead of the opposition, fielding jet aircraft, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, guided bombs, and many other advances years before anybody else. Their great vulnerability was a severe shortage of petroleum reserves, and even this area saw drastic technological advances. Germany developed effective methods of CTL, coal to liquids, fuel production, and put them to work as soon as it became clear that the oil fields of southern Russia were permanently out of reach. The results are instructive. Despite every effort to replace petroleum with CTL and other energy resources, the German war machine ran out of gas. By 1944, the Wehrmacht was struggling to find fuel even for essential operations. The outcome of the Battle of the Bulge in the winter of 1944-45 is credited by many military historians to the raw fact that the German forces didn't have enough fuel to follow up the initial success of their Ardennes offensive. The most innovative technology on the planet, backed up with substantial coal reserves and an almost limitless supply of slave labor, proved unable to find a replacement for cheap, abundant petroleum. It's worthwhile to note that more than 60 years later, no one has done any better. Compare the current situation with the last two energetic transitions, the transition from wind and water power to coal in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, and the transition from coal to petroleum at the beginning of the 20th. And a key distinction emerges. In both the earlier cases, the new energy resource took a dominant place in the industrial world's economies, while the older ones were still very much in use. The world wasn't in any great danger of running out of wind and water in 1750, when coal became the mainspring of the Industrial Revolution, and peak coal was still far in the future in 1900, when oil seized King Coal's throne. The new fuels took over because they were more concentrated and abundant than the competition, and those factors made them more economical than older resources. In both cases, a tide of technological advance followed the expansion of energy resources and was arguably an effect of that explosion rather than its cause. In the 1950s and 1960s, many people expected nuclear power to repeat the process. Those of my readers who were around then will recall the glowing images of atomic-powered cities of the future that filled the popular media in those days. Nothing of the kind happened because nuclear power proved to be so much less economical than fossil fuels. Only massive government subsidies, alongside the hidden quote-unquote energy subsidy it received from an economy powered by cheap fossil fuels, made nuclear power look viable at all. Mind you, uranium contains a very high concentration of energy, though the complex systems needed to mine, process, use, and clean up after it probably use more energy than the uranium itself contains. Most other resources touted as solutions to peak oil either contain much lower concentrations of energy per unit than petroleum, or occur in much lower abundance. This isn't accidental. The laws of thermodynamics mandate that, on average, the more concentrated an energy source is, the less abundant it will be, and vice versa. They also mandate that all energy transfers move from higher to lower concentrations, and this means that you can't concentrate energy without using energy to do it. Really large amounts of concentrated energy occur on Earth only as a side effect of energy cycles in the biosphere that unfold over geological time, unless Connie Barlow and Tommy Gold are correct. That's where coal, oil, and natural gas come from. Except if you take the argument of deep hot biosphere, of course, which they could be right. And then only in specific forms and locations. It took 500 million years to create our planet's stockpile of fossil fuels. Once they're gone, what's left is mostly diffuse sources such as sunlight and wind. And trying to concentrate these so they can power industrial society is like trying to make a river flow uphill. Thus, the role of technological innovation in the rise of industrial economies is both smaller and more nuanced than it's often claimed to be. Certain gateway technologies serve the same function as the mutations in the biological model used earlier in this post. They make it possible to draw on already existing resources that weren't accessible to other technological suites. At the same time, it's the concentration and abundance of the resource in question that determines how much a society will be able to accomplish with it. Improvements to the gateway technology can affect this to a limited extent, but such improvements suffer from the law of diminishing returns backed up again by the laws of thermodynamics. Innovation is a necessary condition for the growth and survival of industrial society. In other words, but not a sufficient condition. If energy resources aren't available in sufficient quality and quantity, innovation can make a successful society, but it won't make or maintain an industrial one. It's worth suggesting that the maximum possible level of economic development in a society is defined by the abundance and concentration of energy resources available to that society. It's equally possible, though this is rather more speculative, that the maximum possible technological level of an intelligent species anywhere in the universe is defined by the abundance and concentration of energy resources on the planet where that species evolves. We'll be talking more about this in next week's post. What we're discussing here is an application of one of the central principles of ecology, Liebig's Law.
Liebig's Law of the Minimum.
Yep, named after the 19th century German agronomist Justus von Liebig, who first proposed it, holds that the maximum growth of a community of organisms is limited by whatever necessary factor in the environment is in shortest supply.
Right on.
A simpler way of stating this law is that necessary resources aren't interchangeable. If your garden bed needs phosphorus, adding nitrogen to it won't help. And if it's not getting enough sunlight, all the fertilizer in the world won't boost growth beyond a certain point. For most of human history, the resource that has been in shortest supply has arguably been energy. For the last 300 years, and especially for the last 3/4 of a century, that's been less true than ever before. Today, however, the highly concentrated and abundant energy resources stockpiled by the biosphere over the last 500 million years or so, again, unless Barlow and Gold are right, And there's no other resources on Earth around at that same level of concentration and abundance. Innovation is vital if we are to deal with the consequences of that reality. But it can't make the laws of thermodynamics run backwards and give us an endless supply of concentrated energy just because we happen to want one.
He is so brilliant.
He is abso-fucking-lutely brilliant. And that's a post I've got to email Mark Perkel. Mm. All right, last post of the day. Do I have time to read it?
Sure.
Solving Fermi's Paradox. Wednesday, September 19th, 2007. Fermi's Paradox. One of the besetting sins of today's intellectual climate is the habit of over-specialization. Too often, people involved in one field get wrapped up in that field's debates and miss the fact that the universe is not neatly divided into watertight compartments. With this excuse, if any is needed, I want to shift the ground of the Archdruid Report's discussion a bit and talk about Fermi's Paradox. First proposed by nuclear physicist Enrico Fermi in 1990, this points out that there is a serious mismatch between our faith in technological progress and the universe our telescopes and satellites reveal to us. Our galaxy is around 13 billion years old and contains something close to 400 billion stars. There's a lot of debate about how many of these stars have planets, how many of those planets are capable of supporting life, and what might or might not trigger the evolutionary process that leads to intelligent, tool-using life forms. But most estimates grant that there are probably thousands or millions of inhabited planets out there. Fermi pointed out that an intelligent species that developed the sort of technology we have today and kept on progressing could be expected eventually to work out a way of travel from one star system to another. They would also leave traces that would be detectable from Earth. Even if interstellar travel proved to be slow and difficult, a species that developed star flight technology, could colonize the entire galaxy in a few tens of millions of years. In other words, in a tiny fraction of the time the galaxy has been around. Given 400 billion chances to evolve the species capable of inventing interstellar travel, and 13 billion years to roll the dice, the chances are dizzyingly high that if it's possible at all, at least one species would have managed the trick long before we came around. And it's not much less probable that dozens or hundreds of species could have done it. If that's the case, Fermi pointed out, where are they? And why haven't we seen the least trace of their presence anywhere in the night sky? Fermi's paradox has been the subject of lively debate for something like half a century now, and most books on the possibility of extraterrestrial life discuss it. There are at least two reasons for that interest. On the one hand, of course, the possibility that we might someday encounter intelligent beings from another world has been a perennial fascination since the beginning of the Industrial Age, a fascination that has done much to drive the emergence of folk theologies masquerading as science in today's UFO movement. On another level, though, Fermi's paradox can be restated in another and far more threatening way. The logic of the paradox depends on the assumption that unlimited technological progress is possible, and that can be turned without too much difficulty into a logical refutation of the assumption.
You know, that's a good point.
So on another level, though, Fermi's paradox can be restated in another and far more threatening way. The logic of the paradox depends on the assumption that unlimited technological progress is possible, and it can be turned without too much difficulty into a logical refutation of the assumption. If unlimited technological progress is possible, then there should be clear evidence of technologically advanced species in the cosmos. There is no such evidence. Therefore, unlimited technological progress is impossible. Crashingly unpopular though this latter idea may be, I suggest that it is correct. And a close examination of the issues involved casts a useful light on the present crisis of industrial civilization. Let's start with the obvious. Interstellar flight involves distances on a scale the human mind has never evolved the capacity to grasp. If the Earth were the size of the letter O on this screen, for example, the Moon would be a little over an inch and three quarters away from it, the Sun about 60 feet away, and Neptune, the outermost planet of our solar system now that Pluto has been officially demoted to a dwarf planet status, a bit more than a third of a mile off. On the same scale, though, Proxima Centauri, the closest star to our solar system, would be more than 3,000 miles away, roughly the distance from southern Florida to the Alaskan panhandle. Epsilon and Eridani, thought by many astronomers to be the closest star enough like our sun to have a good chance of inhabitable planets, he probably meant habitable planets, would be more than 7,500 miles away, roughly the distance from the Pacific Ocean, across the Pacific Ocean, from the west coast of North America to the east coast of China. The difference between going to the moon and going to the stars, in other words, isn't simply a difference in scale. It's a difference in kind. It takes literally unimaginable amounts of energy, either to accelerate to a spacecraft to the relativistic speeds needed to make an interstellar trip in less than a geological time scale, or to keep a manned or aliened spacecraft viable for the long trip through deep space. The Saturn V rocket that put Apollo 11 astronauts on the moon the most powerful spacecraft to date doesn't even begin to approach the first baby steps toward interstellar travel. This deserves attention because the most powerful and technologically advanced nation on Earth, riding the crest of one of the greatest economic boons in history and fueled by and fueling that boom by burning through half a billion years' worth of fossil fuels at an absurdly extravagant pace, had to divert a noticeable fraction of its total resources to the task of getting a handful of spacecraft across what, in galactic terms, is a whisker-thin gap between neighboring worlds. It's been an article of faith for years now, and not just among science fiction fans, that progress will take care of the difference. Progress, however, isn't simply a matter of ingenuity or science. It depends on energy sources, and that meant biomass, wind, water, and muscle until technological breakthroughs opened the treasure chest of the Earth's carbon reserves in the 18th century. If the biosphere had found some less flammable way than coal to stash carbon in the late Paleocene, the Industrial Revolution of the 18th and 19th century wouldn't have happened. If nature had turned the sea life of the Mesozoic into some inert compound rather than petroleum, the transportation revolution of the 20th century would have never gotten off the ground. Throughout the history of our species, in fact, each technological revolution has depended on accessing a more concentrated form of energy than the ones previously available. The modern faith in progress assumes that this process can continue indefinitely. Such an assertion, however, flies in the face of thermodynamic reality. A brief summary of that reality may not be out of place here. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed, and left to itself, it always flows from higher concentrations to lower. This latter rule is what's called entropy. A system that has energy flowing through it, physicists call this a dissipative system, can develop eddies in the flow that concentrate energy in various ways. Thermodynamically, living things are entropy eddies. We take energy from the flow of sunlight through the dissipative system of the Earth in various ways, and use it to maintain concentrations of energy above ambient levels. The larger and more intensive the concentration of energy, on average, the less common it is. This is why mammals are less common than insects, and insects less common than bacteria. It's also why big deposits of oil and coal are much less common than smaller ones, and why oil and coal are much less common than inert substances in Earth's crust. Fossil fuels don't just happen at random. They exist in the Earth because biological processes put them there. Petroleum is the most concentrated of the fossil fuels, and the biggest crude oil deposits, Ghawar in Saudi Arabia, Cantrell in Mexico, the West Texas fields, a handful of others, represent the largest concentrations of free energy on Earth at the dawn of the Industrial Age. They are mostly gone now, along with a great many smaller concentrations, and decades of increasingly frantic searching has failed to turn up anything on their scale, on the same scale. Nor is there another, even more concentrated energy resource waiting in the wings. If progress depends on getting access to ever more concentrated energy resources, in other words, we have reached the end of our rope. The resources now being proposed as ways to power industrial civilization are all much more diffuse than fossil fuels. Nuclear power advocates need to remember that uranium-235, which has a great deal of energy when refined and purified, so the whole system yields very little more energy than goes into it. Fusion, if it even proves workable at all, will require an infrastructure a couple of orders of magnitude more expensive than fission. And the same is true of breeder reactors. More generally, it takes energy to concentrate energy. Once we no longer have the nearly free energy of fossil fuels concentrated for us by half a billion years of geology, concentrating energy beyond a certain fairly modest point will rapidly become a losing game in thermodynamic terms. At that point, insofar as progress is measured by the kind of technology that can cross deep space, progress will be over. We can apply this same logic to Fermi's paradox and reach a conclusion that makes sense of the data. Since life creates localized concentrations of energy, each planet inhabited by life forms will develop concentrated energy resources. It's reasonable to assume that our planet is somewhere close to the average, so we can postulate that some worlds will have more stored energy than ours, and some will have less. A certain fraction of planets will evolve intelligent, tool-using species that figure out how to use their planet's energy reserves. Some will have more and some less. Some will use their reserves quickly and some slowly. But all will reach the point where we are today, the point at which it becomes painfully clear that the biosphere of a planet can only store up a finite amount of concentrated energy. And when it's gone, it's gone. Chances are that a certain number of intelligent species in our galaxy have used these stored energy reserves to attempt short-distance spaceflight, as we have done. Some with a great deal of energy resources may be able to establish colonies on other worlds in their own systems, at least for a time. The difference between tabletop and football field distances needed to travel within a solar system and the continental distances needed to cross from star to star, though, can't be ignored. Given the fantastic energies required, the chance that any intelligent species will have access to enough highly concentrated energy resources to keep an industrial society progressing long enough to evolve star flight technology and then actually accomplish that feat is so close to zero that the silence of the heavens makes perfect sense. These considerations suggest that White's Law, a widely accepted principle in human ecology, can be expanded in a useful way. White's Law holds that the level of economic development in a society is measured by the energy per capita it produces and uses. Since the energy per capita of any society is determined by its access to concentrated energy resources, this holds true whether we are talking about wild foods, agricultural products, fossil fuels, or anything else. It's worth postulating that the maximum level of economic development possible for a society is measured by the abundance and concentration of energy resources to which it has access. It's also worth postulating, along the lines suggested by Richard Duncan's Olduvai theory, that a society's maximum level of economic development will be reached, on average, at the peak of a bell-shaped curve, with a height determined by the relative renewability of the society's energy resources. A society wholly dependent on resources that renew themselves over the short term may trace a bell-shaped curve in which the difference between peak and trough is so small, it approximates a straight line. A society dependent on resources renewable over a longer time scale may cycle up and down as its resource base depletes and then recovers. A society dependent on non-renewable resources can be expected to trace a ballistic curve in which the height of ascent is matched, or more than matched, by the depth of the following decline. Finally, the suggestions made here raise the possibility that for more than a century and a half now, our own civilization has been pushing a misguided image of what an advanced technology looks like. Since the late 19th century, when the early science fiction writers such as Jules Verne began popularizing the concept of advanced technology, quote-unquote, and extravagant use of energy have been for all practical purposes synonyms, and today's Star Wars fantasies tend to dominate any discussion of what a mature technological society might resemble. If access to concentrated energy sources inevitably peaks and declines in the course of a technological society's history, though, a truly mature technology may turn out to be something very different from our current expectations. We'll explore this further in next week's post. The Archdruid Report, Wednesday, September 26th, 2007. Civilization and Succession. In an Archdruid Report post a couple of weeks ago, I used the well-worn metaphor of bacteria in a petri dish to talk about the way that ecological limits constrain the range of possibilities open to any life form, Homo sapiens included. Several people objected to the comparison, insisting basically that human beings are enough smarter than microbes that the same rules don't apply. Flattering to human vanity as this insistence may be, I have to admit to a certain skepticism about the claim, in light of current events. According to the best current figures, world production of petroleum peaked almost 2 years ago and has been declining ever since. World production of all liquid fuels peaked more than a year ago and is likewise declining. Much of the third world is already in desperate straits as its access to fossil fuels dries up. And government and business leaders across the industrial world, which has far more to lose from the twilight of cheap, abundant energy than the third world does, are still treating peak oil as a public relations problem. If we're enough smarter than microbes in a petri dish to escape the same fate, we have yet to demonstrate it. On a deeper level, of course, such comments miss the point just as thoroughly as they claim they're meant to satirize. The value of the petri dish metaphor is that it shows how ecological processes work in a context simple enough to make them clear. The same pattern can be traced in more complex biological systems, human societies among them. The logic of the petri dish, after all, is the same logic that drove die-off on Easter Island and among the lowland Maya. If you use the resources necessary to your survival at an unsustainable rate, you get the classic overshoot curve, population boom followed by population bust. Thus, humanity is no more exempt from ecological processes than from the law of gravity. The invention of airplanes doesn't mean that gravity no longer affects us. It means that if we use a lot of energy, we can overcome the force of gravity and lift ourselves off the ground for a while. The same principle holds with the laws of ecology. Using an immense amount of energy, we lifted a minority of the world's population high above the subsistence level for a while. But that doesn't mean that ecological laws no longer affect us. It means that for 300 years we've been able to push past the limits normally imposed by those laws by burning up huge amounts of fossil fuels. When the fossil fuels are gone, the laws are still there. One of the central principles of ecology, in fact, is that similar patterns can be traced among organisms at different levels of complexity. The difference in intelligence between yeast and deer is many times greater than the difference between deer and human being, and yet deer and yeast alike go through exactly parallel cycles of boom and bust when resource availability, rather than predators, functions as the primary means of population control. Thus, it's reasonable to look to ecological patterns among other living things for clues to the driving forces behind equivalent processes in human societies. One ecological pattern that deserves a special close attention as we begin the long slide down the back end of Hubbard's Peak is the process called succession. Any of my readers who were unwise enough to buy a home in one of the huge and mostly unsold housing developments cranked out at the top of the late real estate bubble will be learning quite a bit about succession over the next few years. So it is useful for more than one reason to summarize it here. Imagine an area of bare bulldozed soil, somewhere where the annual rainfall is high enough to support woodland. Long before the forlorn sign says coming soon luxury homes only 450K falls to the ground, seeds blown in by the wind sent up the first crop of invasive weeds. Those pave the way for other weeds and grasses, which eventually choke out the first comers. After a few years, shrubs and pioneer trees begin rising and become anchor species for a young woodland, which shades out the last of the weeds and the grass. In the shade of the pioneer trees, saplings and other species sprout. If nothing interferes with the process, the abandoned lot can pass through anything up to a dozen different stages before it finally settles down as an old-growth forest community a couple of centuries later. This is what ecologists call succession. Each step along the way from bare dirt to mature forest is a sere, or seral, stage. The same process shapes the animal population of the vacant lot, as one species after another moves into the area for a time until it's supplanted by another better adapted to the changing environment and food supply. It also proceeds underground, as the dizzyingly complex fabric of life that makes up healthy soil reestablishes itself and then cycles through its own changes. Watch a vacant lot in a different ecosystem and you'll see it go through its own sequence of seres, ending up in its own climax community. That's the term for the final, relatively stable sere in a mature ecosystem, like the old growth forest in our example. The details change, but the basic pattern remains the same. Essential to the pattern is a difference in the way that earlier and later seres deal with energy and resources. Species common in the early seres are selected species, in ecologist jargon, usually maximize their control over resources and their production of biomass, even at the cost of inefficient use of resources and energy. Weeds are a classic example of our selected species. They grow fast, spread rapidly, and get choked out when slower-growing plants get established, or the abundant resources that make their fast growth possible run short. Species common in later seres, K-selected species, maximize efficiency in using resources and energy, even when this means accepting limits on biomass production and expansion into available niches. Temperate zone hardwood trees are a classic example of K-selected species. They grow slowly, take years to reach maturity, and endure for centuries when left undisturbed. Apply the model of succession to human ecology and a remarkably useful way of looking at the predicament of industrial society emerges. In successional terms, we are in the early stages of the transition between an R-selected seer and the K-selected seer that will replace it. The industrial economies of the present, like any other R-selected seer, maximizes production at the expense of sustainability. The successful economies of the future, emerging in a world without today's cheap, abundant energy, will need to maximize sustainability at the expense of production, like any other K-selected seer. To put this into the broader picture, it's necessary to factor in the processes of evolutionary change, because climax communities are stable only from the perspective of a human lifetime. Environmental shifts change them, so often on a much faster timescale does the arrival of new species on the scene. Sometimes this latter process makes succession move in reverse for a while. For example, when an invasive seer of R-selected species outcompetes the dominant species of the K-selected climax community, eventually the succession process starts moving forward again. But the new climax community may not look much like the old one. Apply this to the human ecology of North America, say, and it's easy to trace the pattern. A climax community of K-selected Native American horticulturalists and hunter-gatherers was disrupted and largely replaced by an invasive seer of European farmers with a much more R-selected ecology. Not long after the new community established itself and before succession could push it in the direction of more K-selected ecology, a second invasive seer, the industrial economy, emerged, using resources the first two seers could not access. This second invasive seer, the first of its kind on the planet, was on the far end of the R-selected spectrum. Its ability to access and use extravagant amounts of energy enabled it to dominate the farming seer that preceded it and push the remnants of the old climax community to the brink of extinction. Like all R-selected seers, though, the industrial economy was vulnerable on two fronts. Like all early seers in succession, it faced the risk that a more efficient K-selected seer would eventually outcompete it, and its ability to use resources at unsustainable rates made it vulnerable to disruptive cycles of boom and bust that would sooner or later guarantee that a more efficient seer would replace it. Both those processes are well underway. The industrial economy is well into overshoot at this point, and at this point a crash of some kind is pretty much inevitable. At the same time, the more efficient K-selected human ecologies of the future have been sending up visible shoots since the 1970s, in the form of a rapidly spreading network of small organic farms, local farmers' markets, appropriate technology, and alternative ways of thinking about the world, among many other things. Three points deserve to be made in this context. First, one of the differences between human beings and other organisms is that human ecologies are culturally rather than biologically determined. Got that?
Yeah.
The same individuals are at least potentially able to shift from an R-selected to a K-selected human ecology by changing their means of subsistence.
Oh, that's a good point.
Since it's unlikely that a K-selected human ecology can or will be expanded fast enough to take up the slack of the disintegrating R-selected industrial system, there's still likely to be a great deal of human suffering and disruption over the next century or so. Still, those individuals willing to make the transition to a K-selected lifestyle sooner rather than later may find that the disintegration of the industrial system opens up opportunities to survive and even flourish. The second point circles back to the subject of last week's Archdruid Report post, Fermi's Paradox. The assumption at the core of the paradox, as mentioned in that post, is that today's extravagantly energy-wasting system is the wave of the future, and more advanced civilizations than ours will have even more energy and use it even more lavishly. The concept of succession suggests a radically different view of what an advanced civilization might look like. Modern industrial society here on Earth is the exact equivalent of the first sear of pioneer weeds on the vacant lot described above, fast-growing, resource-hungry, inefficient, and designed to be supplanted by more efficient K-selected sears as the process of succession unfolds. A truly advanced civilization, here or elsewhere, might well have more in common with a climax community. It might use very modest amounts of energy and resources with high efficiency, maximum sustainability, and build for the long term. Such a civilization would be hard to detect across interstellar distances, and the limits to the energy resources available to it make it vanishingly unlikely that it would attempt to cross those distances. This would hardly make it a failure as a civilization, except in the eyes of those for whom the industrial age fantasies of science fiction trump all other concerns.
Oh, good point.
The third point leads into issues that will be central to a great many future posts on this blog. The climax community that emerges after a period of prolonged ecological disruption and the arrival of new biotic assemblages rarely has much in common with the climax community that prevailed before the disruptions began. In the same way, and for most of the same reasons, claims that the deindustrial world will necessarily end up as an exact equivalent of some past society, be that medieval feudalism, tribal hunter-gatherer cultures, or anything else, needs to be taken with more than the usual grain of salt. Much of the heritage of today's industrial societies will likely prove unsustainable in the future ahead of us, but not all. Some technologies of the present and recent past could easily continue to play important roles in the human ecologies of the deindustrial future, and many more can help cushion the descent. Tracing out some of the options can help guide today's choices at a time when constructive action is desperately needed.
Wow. That was hopeful.